Okay, let's resume. We're going to continue with our discussion of insurance contracts. The next memo, I believe, is 12C.
Yep.
That would be 61C on contract boundary, and I'm going to hand over to Andrea.
Thank you. Agenda paper 12C addresses contract boundaries for insurance contracts. The proposed model, as you know, includes all the cash flows arising within the contract boundary and the measurement of the liability. So to identify these cash flows, the ED and DP propose a contract boundary principle, which is set out in paragraph 8 of the paper. Most respondents did agree with the contract boundary principle. However, there were a few, particularly health insurers, who were more concerned about how that principle would apply to contracts for which pricing is assessed only at the portfolio level. Many see these contracts as short duration. We set out an extract from the International Federation of Health Plans in Appendix C that sets out all their views. This point also came up in several of the field test reports, and we discussed it with the field test participants at the time, and the examples in Appendix C were derived from some of the field test material. The issue arises when the effective regulation or legislation means that there are requirements to renew and restrictions on an insurer's ability to reprice at renewal. We analysed these concerns into the four areas that are set out in paragraph 20. The first two relate to whether renewal rights provide a substantive right to the policyholder and therefore a substantive obligation for the insurer. And we recommend that there's a contract boundary when the insurer is no longer required to provide coverage and the existing contract does not confer substantive rights. And we see that really as a clarification of the principle in the ED. In the last point in 20D, we look at whether there's a difference between restrictions imposed by law, legislation, or in the contract itself. And we think it should not matter what imposes the restrictions, it's the restrictions themselves that matter. The main part of the paper deals with the point in 20C, which is whether we should look at assessing the ability to reprice the risk at an individual policyholder level, as is in the EDDP, or at a portfolio level, as proposed by the health insurers and others. The main consequence of an assessment at a portfolio level is to shorten the contract boundary for contracts that include provision of any type for repricing at the portfolio level. And one consequence of this, and the reason we think that there's so much interest in the contract boundary question, is that these contracts might, as a result, fall into the modified approach. So on the face of it, assessment at a portfolio level is consistent with the general unit of account in the ED and DP. However, the portfolio unit of account applies to measurement. And we think that the contract boundary is an issue that is really about whether or not there's a contract there to measure. In other words, we think it's a recognition type issue. And recognition can only be performed at a contract level because the rights and obligations arise at the contract level. We tested out the idea of assessing the risk at a portfolio level with some insurers, and we were told that many long-term insurance contracts also have the ability to increase premiums to recover costs at the portfolio level, and that if we change the assessment of risk to the portfolio level, that might create problems for writers of long-duration contracts, which would then also have a shortened contract boundary. And we've set out the concerns in paragraph 36. So as a result of these factors, the main staff recommendation in the paper is to confirm the position in the exposure draft of the MDP. However, we're sympathetic to the practical implications for some insurers, especially when the practical effect of the ability to reprice at the portfolio level means that the insurer will always be able to set premiums in a way that always covers the risks in any given year into the future. So as a result, we try to analyse why it was that some people instinctively think of health insurance as long-term and others instinctively think of it as being short-term. And that analysis suggested to us that one of the differences is that it's that the premiums in the early years somehow contain an element of prepayment for premiums in later years. It's this sort of level premium over the life of the contract issue. This is almost always what happens in the long-duration health ones, and that's the case. One possibility, if the board is so-minded, is to modify the contract boundary principle so that a portfolio assessment could apply only in the case where there's no element of prepayment in the premiums for the current year to cover the risks of future years. So the words in the second half of the question two box is my attempt to do that. It's effectively an exception to have an assessment at a portfolio level for some contracts without causing problems for long duration contracts that also have the ability to request at the portfolio level. We've tested this out with one or two friendly insurers, and we've been told that one of the main raises of this concern to us is happy with the words in the second half of the question two box, and we're also told that for one or two long duration contract writers that they're also happy with that as well. It doesn't seem to cause problems for the contracts that they have. However, on balance, and I have to say it's a relatively finely balanced leaning, most staff put more weight that led to the main staff recommendation. And that's that the contracts do create an obligation for the insurer. The obligations exist at an individual contract level, and that the question is related more to recognition than measurement. So that's behind the main staff recommendation in the paper. I believe the leaning goes the other way for other staff, so perhaps Jennifer can provide some colour around the considerations behind the tone of staff gave.
Thank you, Andrea. And a few of the things I'm going to say are going to clarify a few of things that Andrea said. As she did note, that the biggest impact is on health insurers, it also does affect reinsurers, also auto insurers. While this is predominantly from a standpoint of regulatory, it's not always. This is just how some of these contracts are written. In regards to, I guess to take a step back, all contracts, no matter what business you're in, is priced based on risks and bands and what bands you're put in. So for a life contract, you look at, you know, everyone is put into a specific band based on the age, based on your gender, based on whether you're a smoker or a non-smoker. For auto insurance, it's based on what risks you're put into, based on jurisdictional location, your age, gender, your prior driving record. And then for health insurers, for the most part, a lot of times it's similar concepts. However, in some situation, these concepts such as age and pre-existing conditions do not affect the pricing, which is equalized across the policyholders with different risk profiles, perhaps by the legal requirements. So what happens in some of these contracts is you are first underwritten and you're put into this portfolio. In subsequent years, you continue and you're put into sort of a renewal portfolio, and these insurers price for that portfolio to recover the costs. The costs from that portfolio do get allocated to each of the individual insurers, each of the individual policyholders. So one policyholder's price might go up, and most likely with certain of these, and health insurance, unfortunately, with medical costs increasing, does go up. And therefore, many of the companies that we heard from would say that the ability to reprice at the portfolio level is what should be the contract boundary, because they are repricing for basically increasing the individual contract prices. These insurers also have the ability to exit business. So, for instance, certain types of business, Medicare here in the U.S., would be by county by county. They can exit, and they do exit. Other types of business, such as small group or individual health, they can exit, and that's more based on a city or state. And we also understand internationally, based on all of the feedback that was received, companies do exit. And I hate using that argument, but they basically say that they do exit when they can't get that cost, of course, across the portfolio. So theoretically, the price that they get for the portfolio should be equivalent, it's hard to prove, to the same price as if they were individually re-underwriting each individual in the pool. In regards to how this would affect other types of certain types of what we typically look at as long-duration business. I know we're trying to stay away from the long-duration, short-duration, but since that's been raised, is in that pricing is there are contracts that are going to be a longer duration, such as a 10-year, and they're going to say, you can pay me $100 every year, and I guarantee renewability. Well, part of that is because in the early years, you have a financing component. If you really looked at their pricing, they only need 70 or 80. In the later years, they need 115, 120, etc. So it is a financing component, but they've guaranteed this rate of 100. Those are looked at as long duration and would continue to be looked at as long duration in this because the future risks, the pricing for those future risks are being priced up front. However, on other types of business, they can't and don't price for that future risks. They don't know what medical costs are going to be in year two or year three, and I think we can all relate to that. And so, therefore, when it's in this portfolio and they can reprice the portfolio to reflect those risks of the additional components for medical costs for people in that pool, which they can't assess for how much they've utilized certain of the features of the contract, the existing conditions, since it's no longer pre-existing conditions, those do get priced for. So based on those factors, I think that I would say, and I would say that the staff is split, so there was not a majority of staff on one side. I think it was, however you want to say it, split, was that where the pricing of risks at a portfolio level does not include risks relating to future period, these staff believe that the contract does not contain a financing element, and therefore the view of these staff, the contract boundary principle, should be modified for those contracts for which the pricing of the premiums at a portfolio level does not include risks relating to future periods. And therefore, the determination should be done at a portfolio level rather than an individual contract level, which is also what we've been talking about when we measure the contract itself. And that's what we're talking about here is extending the contract boundary to that measurement and including future periods. I think one point was made was, well, if you get into the modified approach, does that solve it? And will companies be happy just with getting into the modified approach? And that really does not solve it because that just changes from an incurred loss model to an expected, or from an expected loss model in the building block to really an incurred loss model in the modified approach. However, these companies would still have to estimate going out for another year and potentially multiple years the additional unearned premium reserve that they'd be writing, including all the premium that they would charge, including, you know, the recovery for the cost, for the medical cost. So,
I understand. Could I ask a question? I'm just trying to understand where this might take us. I understand the situation for health insurers, and I think they've been consistently raising this point with us. And I think maybe we can all get our hands around that one, but what I think we need to understand is if we go down this path, what else is going to be swept into a modified approach that we would intuitively think would you would apply a building block approach to? And one example that's been raised with us a number of us, I think, is where you've got sort of a plain vanilla term life type policies, and you can reprice on a portfolio basis each period. And arguably then probably the premiums, using your terminology, the premiums that you charge on a periodic basis are not meant to cover those future periods because you can reprice each period on a portfolio basis. So if I understand that's the way it works, would they, like under this approach, like health insurance, be swept into the modified approach and not the building block approach?
My understanding is in those situations, Warren, that there are certain terms that are short duration, and they are accounted for that way today. The ones that you are talking about, they have the ability if mortality or if certain experience is worse than they thought. But that is not saying that the price today for the first year or the second year or the third year does not assume it being a long duration already and does not already have a financing component to it. So where they go back and add, which in some situations, particularly to a company that I know was that both sides have talked to, is it rarely is done to go back and charge for additional for mortality, worse mortality experience. And so they would not be grouped into here because their pricing up front is assuming not for that 1 year, it's assuming a long duration type contract, even though they get to, I look at their reassessment, their repricing is an additional add-on price, not a re-underwriting for those specific risks. And they do that at the portfolio level across the board.
If we're talking about the same organisation that's been speaking to us, I know that they've spoken to Andrew and Peter. I'm not sure whether they've spoken to yourself, Jennifer, but I just want to get an understanding of the way that pricing works. I thought that it was more of an annual-based pricing, in effect, because they have that ability under the contract to do that. And I wasn't convinced that it was necessarily a pricing that was based on sort of a longer-term view. But I don't know whether Peter and Andrea have any comments on that. I'm just trying to understand what might happen here.
I'd like to comment a bit. You raised the 10-year contract, sort of straightforward 10-year plain vanilla contract.
It's a plain vanilla, though, no option.
No. But what would be implicit in the pricing of the annual premium for that is the assumption it's a 10-year contract, and you'd expect that it would be a sort of level-ish premium over the 10 years. And as risks change over time, then it's likely that in the initial years you're paying a little bit more premium than you actually really need to, a little bit less the later years. And so for that sort of contract, it wouldn't come into this alternative view because the pricing of the premiums would include risks relating to future periods. Right? For the health organisation that's been talking to us, they look at it pretty much year by year. They look at it overall in that year and set the premiums based on what they expect in the year coming ahead. We've checked with them and they think that this wording would be acceptable to them.
The alternative wording
would be acceptable.
It's interesting because those that have a view that in these plain vanilla term lifetime contract arrangements, those that have a view that a better approach is a modified approach, would argue that they can in substance re-underwrite each period to reflect the changed circumstances.
On a portfolio basis.
On a portfolio basis. They can get to the same end even though they're not doing it in a way, contract by contract. That's the point I've heard.
Yeah, it's partly exacerbated by it's very difficult for them to estimate what future expenses and premiums will be. They can estimate it fairly easily over the short term, but for the long term, it's very difficult for them to do that. But because of the way the renewal rights are structured, then they would have to do that under the building block approach.
I was going to say that this also, obviously we're focusing on health insurance because that's the one that's, it affects the most, but this also does apply to certain locations for auto insurance when you can't cancel a policyholder, and for homeowners insurance in certain jurisdictions or locations that are prone to hurricanes or potentially even to earthquakes, once they're a policyholder, you can't cancel it, you do have to take it. So, and they do price based, and we do see insurance companies exiting those markets when they can't get the price that they need to get for the portfolio, which essentially would be as if they were repricing the individual contracts as well.
One of the other things that came up in our conversation with one of the health insurers is, do they always want to treat it as an annual contract or not? And the question we asked them is, what happens if you get into the death spiral where you're only left with the people whose health is deteriorating, good ones are all going, and are they always actually able to reprice at the portfolio level to recover what they need? And they said that there are occasions when there aren't, and in those cases they thought they ought to book an extra liability in those cases. And that rather complicated it for us. I mean, up to that point in the discussion I was quite tempted to say, yes, conceptually it probably is a long duration contract really, but maybe as a practical expedient of some kind you could just assume it will wash through in subsequent pricing. But then if there are some circumstances when it doesn't all wash through, then it seems like he was trying to cater for that possibility as well in some way.
If we don't mind, Elizabeth, I'll just continue on this for a minute. Our rationale, I gather, if we were to entertain this as a sort of practical expedient, would be that, in effect, because they can reprice period by period, and premiums tend to be set on an annual basis, that they're not exposed to the risk that you are when you can't reprice at an individual contract level. And I hear what you say, Peter, that if we went to the modified approach, I guess then you're going to fall back on the liability adequacy test, and that has to be robust enough to pick up
The trouble is that wouldn't work by itself. If you've already thrown those cash flows out of the contract boundary, then they're not going to fall into the adequacy test either.
Okay, because you're only talking about the existing contracts. That's a problem.
Okay, Russ?
Yeah, thank you. Jennifer, when you started, you said auto health and reinsurance. What type of reinsurance contracts do you have in your mind that would be impacted? And are they reinsuring health and auto, or are they reinsuring other assets?
That's a good point. Well, there's two. So there's one, if those reinsurers who are reinsuring these types of contracts, obviously, and most of those reinsurance contracts are written as a annual contract for auto, and also if the health insurer, you know, not enter into the health insurance or into the reinsurance, but if they have the reinsurance on that, the reinsurance would only be for a year. However, the underlying contract could go on to be estimating future premiums, future costs, everything else for years and years and years out. So that does cause a disconnect. Also, there are certain types of reinsurance contracts that are continuous quota share contracts where some companies have said that they will continue to offer the quota share that's a percentage and keeping it's a 50% quota share. Now, sometimes they can adjust either the ceding commission for that, but sometimes they can't necessarily cancel it. So those are... There are some of those types of contracts out there that have been raised.
Larry?
Yeah. I guess this goes to Andrea. Paragraph 36, you express, I think, concern about the unintended consequences of going to the alternative view. I said in paragraph 36, you indicate your concern for unintended consequences with respect to the alternative view, and then you lay out two fact patterns, I guess, in A and B, or two concerns that you have. Are there other specific concerns besides those, or does that kind of sum up?
36 isn't so much about the alternative view itself, it's about view which would have gone further, that would say that all portfolio, all contracts for the portfolio level, not the...
Not
you would
specific.
Try to restrict it. So if you did it for every contract, every product that was priced to be priced at the portfolio level, I think by restricting it to only those, then these get alleviated.
Okay.
Yeah. And these really came up because the Solvency II contract boundary is at the portfolio level, and there's been a considerable amount of disquiet in Europe about that, and they wanted to go back to the individual contract level because of these problems.
I think we had a slightly more general concern as well, which we haven't been able to get there fully yet. And that's that the original suggestion for contract boundary work came from some work that was done by the IIAS and also by the CFO Forum, and they did quite a lot of work on it and came up with something that they felt worked across the range of things they'd looked at. And we discussed a range of numbers with them at the time and it seemed to work, and they seemed to come up with something that worked, and we ended up with something that was similar in need. It might even be the same way. So they tested it quite thoroughly. Now, we've talked to them a bit, and CFO Forum particularly have raised some concerns about it. We've identified here a couple of particular cases we're aware of. So I think we've got a slight concern still. There may be some unintended consequences that we haven't been able to identify yet.
I think my major concern with this, and I'm fairly new to staff view or the alternative staff view, but my major concern is about unintended consequences. And I think when there's one thing for sure, Jennifer, then it is that that health insurance in any jurisdiction is different to health insurance in any other jurisdiction. And there are a lot of our markets where health insurance is quite significant, private health insurance schemes, and they are clearly considered to be non-long-term business. And I'm just a bit worried that we might unintendedly put too much business to be into the short-term bucket. Now, am I really concerned about the short-term bucket? Probably more, less from a conceptual point, because for me it's the same model I'm using. It's the same measurement approach. But I'm very concerned that someone who's considered this to be an ongoing contract with ongoing premium and a long-term commitment is then forced to consider himself to be on an annual contract basis with all the questions for the onerous contract test around it. So I would probably try to test it with the major markets whether this alternative staff view really doesn't cause any unintended consequences, because I think it's always fair. The ED didn't cause any major problems to, for example, my home country, so no one really commented on it. You're not commenting on, but you could do something like this and that, and that and that. So I would probably test it with the markets, then I would be neutral to the alternative. I would clearly be against a full-fledged portfolio view, because that would drop by far too many contracts into considered, perceived to be annual contracts that are de facto long-term contracts.
Just a couple things. Well, one on the Warren brought up the life, the term life, and you had mentioned it on the health, that they could and in fact did exit contract. Can they do that on the life? Or do they have to wait till the 10 years is up?
Well, I mean, I think that if it's a 10-year term and they're going back and reassessing, but they're, I mean, where it's confusing is, I guess maybe I'm confused a little bit, because if I've got a 10-year term, I've priced it for the 10-year term, I can go back and do another assessment across the board. So I've already priced it as a long term, so I can't exit if I've already committed to them. Versus on the other, if it was a 1-year term, life, or a health insurance, I've committed to them only for that 1 year. I have a guaranteed renewal if I'm, you know, still there, and then that's going to be priced on the portfolio basis. So, or I can exit them.
So that's one. I had a question about your question. In question two, you ask whether you agree, and you say if you don't agree, would you consider this?
Yeah.
I thought I could agree with the first one and still want to do the second.
The first, well, the question two. So the question one and the first part of question two is alternative one. Only is the last part of question two alternative two. So the question one, I guess maybe we take it as, you know, the first one was, the question one is, do the boards agree that contract renewal should be treated as a new contract when the insurer is no longer required to provide coverage, or the existing contract does not confer on the policyholder any substantive rights? And so then that goes into, do you agree that this should be done on a particular policyholder level, or the alternative view is, do you do this on a portfolio level?
I think he's saying that you should read the first question as an only in there. Then you can answer if it's only at a particular policyholder level, you stop there. But those of us that might want to answer the second question right might want to answer the first question yes, too.
So I was just confused. So, and then I guess the other point I wanted to make, I thought, and I did not support the renewal thing, because it seemed to me that it was an intangible. But the argument put forward was, you can't get out of this. You can't reprice it. You're stuck with the thing. And so it seemed to me that made sense. It was, I used the thinking of writing options, but it seems to me it did make sense. It also seems that if I can get out of this obligation by putting a couple of things together and repricing a portfolio, I don't have an obligation. So I would support the other one. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I support it on a portfolio basis. Because if I can effectively get out of it, I don't have an obligation. And that's the way I that's the way I thought you defined that.
It's not so much that you don't have an obligation, it's just that you have the ability to get the other stuff that it neutralizes the obligation.
You can't get out of the contract in these cases. Yeah. You just can reprice it. On a portfolio,
To me, if I can reprice it, I don't have the problem of being locked in.
Well, that gets back to the problem on us.
In the negotiation.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Daryl? Just more clarification than anything else. If I understood paragraph 29 correctly, what we were effectively saying is the current wording as it stands and the wording of the main view is that there is no substantive right for the policyholder to if you can only reprice that policyholder can be repriced to the same price that a new entrant to the portfolio would pay.
I think it goes a little bit beyond what was in the EP. I think it just makes more explicit some of the basis in the EP and brings that into the
fold. That in turn means then that if you are able to reprice the portfolio such that a new entrant will pay exactly what the existing entrant pays at that point in time, then we've in fact captured a lot of the boundary issue here already with the main staff view, is that right? Because the substantive wording is already in the main staff view.
I think it's how you interpret that B part of the main question one, that the differences appear. I think it's quite difficult to say that on a new entrant can have the same rights as a portfolio, because part of the thing is that within the portfolio, some of them have rights and others apply to. So it's quite difficult to answer that part of your question.
I wish I can just repeat what I think Jennifer had said. Seems as though the staff is asking us in the first question, do we agree with the way we're changing the articulation of when a pricing effect represents a new contract? Then the next question is, at what unit of account are we going to evaluate? And that is the difference between the staff view and the
level of
unit. Okay. Thank you. Stephen?
I disagree with John, and I don't like the portfolio view on this, because it seems to me that you've got a loss on a particular contract, and we're saying, okay, you don't have to recognize that loss as long as you expect that future contracts or future renewals will give me sufficient profit to offset that loss. And there may be some behavioral aspect to renewals that you might feel, well, there's reasonable expectation this will happen, but to my mind, these are future profits. It's like a construction company saying, I've got a bad contract here, it's costing me a lot of money, but don't worry, I'll get a whole lot more construction contracts next year that'll give me sufficient profit, so I won't book the loss now. It seems to me that we're doing a bit of income smoothing here.
Just future contracts, too, because they're repricing existing contracts out of the portfolio.
Yeah, but they're existing contracts and they're renewals, and these are renewals that the policyholders don't have to do, which is, I think, Peter's point.
Yeah, but they're still part of the existing contract, but I think there is another dimension to what Steve said that's probably not explicit in the paper, which is I think this pricing at the portfolio level is probably not a closed portfolio, it's probably actually an open portfolio.
And it's a portfolio that there's no guarantee that you're going to keep these customers. The people that don't have health problems and you're jacking up the premiums because of those people that have and you've suffered those losses, there's no reason why they have to stay with you.
Which is the death spiral pandemic.
And that's exactly what Peter was saying.
Can I get back in on
this?
That's not my point. I guess you're not. The way I think of this, it's not that they can, that the customer can back away. The issue was that the insurer could not. But if the insurer can't back away and it can reprice at market, there isn't a liability because you're at fair value. That, so it's not the fact that the customer can get out of this. The liability is I wrote the option, if I wrote the policy, I'm stuck with it, and I can't reprice it. So when it's renewed off-market. If I can reprice it at market, there's no liability.
I don't have a problem when it's repriced at the individual contract level, that's clear. It's when it's being repriced at the portfolio level, and there's no guarantee that you will keep those customers.
And you're the one that's in the past, why would we treat the same thing differently if we put two together? And now you want to.
No, that's different.
I thought the whole basis for the use of the portfolio as the unit of account for the measurement of these contracts ongoing was that you should not have a significant difference for the one contract versus the whole. So I don't understand why we take such a significantly different view on this issue.
Yeah, exactly. Can I ask on that point? Still, I'm not quite sure. On a portfolio basis, you can replace, but on the individual current existing standards contract, It is not. So how do you, so rather than having the new contract, how do you apply that notion?
So if I take the row of you, so I don't point out any one person, if something happens to one of you, there's something bad that happens, and I won't say John because I don't want to foreshadow anything. So something bad happens to one of you. Either something bad happens to one of you, or nothing happens to any of you, but just in general, medical costs go up. I now will reprice all of you, and you will all pay essentially the same rate that will cover me. If I do not think I'm going to get covered as the health insurer, I can exit that market. So I'm going to look at all of you. So one of you might, you know, do something bad and have a condition or whatnot, and that will affect everybody in the portfolio. Or if medical costs go up, I would be able to charge all of you across the board that price. So versus making each one of you take a physical every single year.
So that means that I have my own contract, and I pay $10 this year. But due to the John's death, so
So then
next year my cost will increase 11 or 12.
Yes, across the board, say every one of you.
So that means individual contract basis, my price is revised, it seems to be.
Yes.
What I do not understand is if my contract is only affected irrespective of others, but say in this portfolio basis also affects my price.
Yep.
So what's the difference between the focus on the individual and the portfolio?
If they had priced you separately, your price would have gone up well beyond 12.
John's also only goes up to 12.
But the point which we are discussing is whether, say, my contract price will be revised. I don't care how, but say, I'm paying $10, but say next year I have to pay more. So that means that either individual contract or portfolio basis, if I have been affected, I don't think there is a difference.
Surely that's assuming you don't have to pay that additional amount. You can decide.
You can go to a different company and pay 10 to them.
Pay 11 to somebody else.
Yeah, but to say in that case it's a new contract, it seems to me.
Yes, but that's the point, that you could just go off to someone else and pay them $10.50 instead of paying your existing $1.12 to cover for John's.
But if the insurer, if the insurer doesn't get that higher price, the insurer can walk. And you said they've done it.
No, the insurer, well, so they have to exit the whole county or hand back their license again, because what we heard.
And it's the guarantee for that year. So the next, so I've already written, so say Tatsumi decides not to come in this year, I'm looking at this across the board for that year. At that point in time, I'd know for 1 year what the premium I'm getting, what I think my costs are going to be. The following year, I will reprice that, or if I can't get those priced, because there are certain jurisdictions that cap the increases you can get, is when companies do potentially exit.
And they can't all walk. They can in some circumstances.
And they make that assessment on a portfolio basis.
The point you made before, though, if the customer doesn't like the price, he can walk. I don't see how that matters.
Well, that's the death spiral. If all the ones that can walk, then you're left with, you price the ones that don't want to walk anymore because you won't be able to raise the premiums enough.
To confuse us totally, I think you need to make sure that you are partially in a rate-regulated industry, which isn't existing in Europe anymore, but which is still existing here. And that's what you mentioned by some of the prices are set.
So why weren't facts like that included in constructive view, both either rate-regulated, capped, and or the ability to walk? It seems to me that...
I think it's in the memo. We just didn't put it in the final piece. But
yeah, well, I'm voting on the words in the final piece. The ability to walk is important to me. The insurer's ability to walk.
My impression was that that's a specific scenario, a specific market. I don't know how universal it is. And the issue applies more broadly, even when the ability to walk isn't there. And so we were looking at it more broadly, and that's an additional factor in a particular market. So I think you need to consider it without specifically focusing and homing in on the ability to walk.
Well, I'm asking, did you think about adding that as an additional factor?
Yeah, I think that is discussed in the paper where it says, some suggested you should add a wording that says that if you're restricted by regulation or legal, that, you know, that this one's applied. I think the staff said, that's the business you're operating in. So you know that, so we wouldn't think that you should restrict it based on regulatory or legal rights in a specific jurisdiction, but rather the nature of the business and the pricing of the business is where you would, how you would look at that. So we didn't, I think that in fact, up front, Andrea.
Yeah, it's mentioned in paragraph 48.
Yep.
So would John be subject to an owner's contract test?
John's dead.
I mean, if you think about it, if John's price goes up and not all the way, are we going to have the pricing and then an owner's contract test on the individual level?
We've said that the owner's contract test would be done at a portfolio level, going down to a cohort level by the year of which they're in.
Well, can I ask a question on that? I mean, when you read the box on top of above paragraph 43, where you said when the insurer has the right or the practical ability to reassess the risk of the portfolio the contract belongs to, and as a result can set the price that fully reflects the risk of that portfolio. Okay, in Stephen's situation, where people are walking, all right, and you have rate increase restrictions, isn't there a point in time where you can't do it anymore, so therefore that will throw you into the long...
Yes.
Well, that was the point that exchange Peter and I had in terms of what the onerous contract means. And Peter's right, because it's only going to apply to existing contracts, whether at an individual or portfolio level. And so then you're going to drop then into FAS 5, IS 37 to pick up the obligation that you've got in respect of the fact that these policyholders are leaving and you're not going to be able to recover the cost that you expect to incur on the remaining policyholders, I presume.
And you wouldn't have been able to fully reprice.
Yeah,
exactly.
But that's the point. The point that you can't fully reprice,
right.
Aren't you out?
Well, you can't have a long duration.
Well,
we haven't discussed that. I mean, with many of these things, we say, you know, you make your decision at inception and you stick with it. And what some people are saying is, well, maybe as long as you continue to qualify. I guess it gets back to the rationale that I asked before. What's the rationale for doing this? Because we don't think that you're going to be subjected to the risks that you normally would in the long term. Contracts that you pick up through the building blocks approach, and so the monitoring approach is adequate. But I think what people are saying is if indeed you then become subjected to those risks, then you must drop into the building block model.
We assess only at inception for a contract, don't we?
Well,
so far.
But that's what we do, and I think people are saying maybe we need to reopen it.
I think that's the point we need to actually address in the ED, and we probably need to pick up is what happens when those future cash flows become contracts. Do you treat them as a new contract, or do you treat them as becoming an addition to the existing contract?
And the modified approach, just to clarify, is not going to solve this situation if you were to go in a modified approach, because the wording in the modified approach says, right now at least, estimate all the future expected future premiums within the contract boundary. So you would still have to assess that the health insurer charged or whatever insurer charged a premium this year. They have to assess how much they think medical costs would go up going on for however long, that they would then increase their premium price for those, and how many then of the policyholders would stay with them and what their costs might be. So the modified approach does not I just don't want to give the impression that the modified approach and getting into that solves this issue.
It would be what if they want to use some, the same sort of phenomenology approach as a, on a rather than specifically the modified approach as we have that set type in the meeting.
Question for you, for either Andrea or Jennifer, and this may be specific to the U.S. market, sure. But to what extent were you thinking of, with respect to the alternative approach, the pricing of group health insurance versus individual insurance in the way prices are adjusted? Granted, you know, if let's say John has to apply for individual health insurance, he's not a member of a plan, of an employer-based plan, and he has guaranteed renewability, but he is subject to a class that is subject to repricing. So are you saying that his particular contract would be eligible for the alternative view? I understand it in the context of a group plan, because as you say, like Stephen said, employees can drop in and out every year. On November 1st, everybody gets a notification of enrollment. I can decide to stay with, say, Oxford. I can leave Oxford and go to United or go to Aetna, depending on what I think the relative value is for the price. But John, as an individual, doesn't have that luxury. He needs insurance. If he's got a pre-existing condition, he may not be able to flip over to another plan, because they do a little bit more detailed underwriting, right, as opposed to a group plan where everybody's kind of. So does this apply to all kinds of plans? Are we overlaying a solution that works for everything, or just particular types of?
Our belief would be that this would work for even the individual and talking to companies. And part of that is, yes, he's underwritten in year one. If there's a guaranteed renewal, it's on a renewal group or renewal portfolio, even for individuals, and those prices would go up for all of those individuals, no matter what. Now, obviously, if he wanted to go somewhere else, the price might be prohibitive for him to go elsewhere. And insurers can price it so that it's prohibitive. You know, it's only when they've got rate caps that they can't price it above a certain price. Therefore, they might have to be forced to exit an area. If they don't have a cap, they will reprice it up to a level that people would potentially want to walk because it would be too high.
There's a brief discussion in paragraph 52 about group plans, and I think the gist of what it's saying there is that you have to look at the facts and circumstances to decide whether it's a single contract or whether it's a series of separate contracts with each individual.
Mark, did you want to say something?
Nothing incremental at this point.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a question. If we vote yes for the portfolio view, would we anticipate, would the staff think that there would be memos that would come back then evaluating reassessment and subsequent accounting, if what happens is you can't fully reprice because there's a cap, and therefore you go long duration? Would it be naturally think for the staff that's supporting this alternative view that there'd be follow-on reporting or accounting that you'd have to bring to us?
Again, in the modified approach, it says look to all the premium within the contract boundary, and it specifically says to the contract boundary. So you would have to then essentially look out multiple years.
Why wouldn't you just reevaluate it every year? If you're not a long duration, okay, isn't your boundary just for the next contract year, and then in that new year, you have to reassess it? So effectively, if you're in the death spiral, mode, there's a point in time where you're no longer going to be able to pass on that risk, and it's at that point in time that you would convert to a.
I think that's worse. That's right. What if you no longer meet the condition of the ability to fully reprice, then the boundary would get expanded.
Well, that's what I'm asking.
That's what he's asking.
I'm asking, I think we decided that you decide whether you're in the modified approach or the full model on day one, and you walk it out. I'm very sympathetic to this alternative view, because I believe that there's unintended consequences to looking at this at the individual contract level for these sorts of contracts. But if we got to the death spiral, like Larry was saying, I would expect perhaps for those that qualify for short duration because of this condition, that if you got into the death spiral sort of view, you would have to reassess whether it's short term or long term, go to long duration. And then when you go to long duration, there might be knock-on effects as to how you have to do the accounting. Mm-hmm. Would you build whatever's left over in the one-year model into the full model, or you'd have a new model? Those are the two things I think we have to think about. And if we did that, I feel very comfortable that I'd like to vote for this.
Why would you have to go to the long-duration approach? Why wouldn't you just put up an additional liability in accordance with 5 or 37?
Well, because...
Can I quickly give an update what I heard from the outreach, because we are now here in the public goods provision. I mean, I think Pat Finnegan already touched on this. Those insurers, well, provide kind of public goods, and this is the problem we're having here. And what I heard is from the outreach, the only problems we face is with health insurance and with some kind of hurricane insurance we already heard, so where you only can get rid of those contracts if you really leave that region. And I think what I heard is that there's really a cap, it's maybe from the government or from the regulator, a cap of how much more you can price on a portfolio level, like for Florida if there's a hurricane happening. So I'm not sure if you can fully reassess on a portfolio level in these cases.
Well, I think the answer to your question goes to some confusion I was having and what Jen was saying about the modified approach. If you're in a death spiral and you think of yourself as short duration, pardon the expression, and John's in the hospital on December 31st with leprosy.
Leprosy, no.
I don't have an onerous contract
where he is on December
until John pays his next premium on January 31st.
That's true.
And I think that was Peter's point. I don't see anything in our existing shortcut model that would force me to assume that John will do the rational thing and pay the next premium so he can stay in the hospital.
But aren't you on the hook for the period that you provided cover?
Yes. I'm on the hook for midnight December 31st.
Right, and that's on that basis I would think you would at least have to put up.
But I don't have to pick up the fact that he's going to be in the hospital for five more years as long as he pays what compared to his cost as a de minimis premium.
Understood. So, yeah. But that's the case. It was long duration, too.
If it's long duration, there's no question that I have to figure the whole thing. Yeah, He's not in the short term.
If the claim is incurred in 2011, I am estimating costs for that claim, for that incident, forever. So if he's got leprosy and is in the hospital on that day, then that is a claim incurred during that period of time that I should be estimating what the cost to fulfill that claim are going on forever. It is not a claims made basis, and I guess in this case it would be that claim made in that period.
I think what Jennifer and I are arguing back and forth is a long standing issue in the United States, at least it was when last I looked on health insurers. But I think Peter's right. We have to clarify which you fall into and whether or not you have to reassess. If you have to reassess, then it works exactly the way Jennifer all the time. So if you're in a death spiral, you'd always flip over. If you make the decision at inception, which I think is what our current view is, then the fact that it might be onerous if you were something else doesn't matter, because you made your decision at inception and you live with it. So I think those
probably seem to me to be the two issues that you have to deal with.
Well, that's what I was raising.
And also, if you did reassess, we'd also have to assess what implications of that might be for other types of contracts.
Well, you could limit the reassessment to ones that get into short duration for this criteria, based on this criteria.
But we'd have to consider that.
Short
duration into long.
Yes. I'm also in the same camp as Tom. I'm sympathetic to this, but I'd like to see how it plays out in those scenarios. So I think the staff would need to think something there.
Okay, let's take the questions one at a time. Are people generally supportive of the modification of the staff is proposing? To question 1B, in other words, that the existing contract doesn't confer any substantive rights to the existing policyholder that can't be enjoyed by any new policyholder?
Yeah.
People supportive of that?
Yes.
Okay. So going to question 2, I'm going to basically ask the question as a unit of account question. Would you make that assessment only at the particular policyholder, or would you make the assessment, at the portfolio level, but only if it does not include risks relating to future periods? Okay, so who would support only at the individual policyholder level?
FASB
with the other one. So I'm assuming who would support the assessment at the portfolio level, leaving out future risks? ISB?
Yeah, mine's a subject two. I want clarification.
Okay.
I could live with that one.
Yeah. And mine is subject two. This course fully reflects the risks.
Okay.
I plus a couple of other too. So.
Okay. So we're going to want some more analysis of this.
And Leslie, believe it or not, I'm here. It's Pat McConnell, and I'm voting. Yes.
How are you?
For the portfolio head?
See you.
Yes.
It's not. Yeah.
Okay, thanks. And FASB, who supports the portfolio approach?
7.
Okay, thank you. Question 3? Okay. So question 3 is essentially saying, do we want to make an exception if the changes in the contract boundary were related to things imposed by regulation or law? So please sit back to the question. Would we want to make an exception? Anyone in support of that? No.
I was just trying to understand your question.
I did
versus,
say it back.
Yes.
I did say it back in the opposite, but I think I got the message. All right, first one.
Yep.
Okay.